victory to motivate the rest of the population to fight back.
All right. And on that note, unfortunately, we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Bob Gill, NHS campaigner and producer of the Great NHS Heist out of London, and Shabir Razvi, economic and political analyst, also out of London. Thank you both. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21 of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Young.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أن مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا صبر صبرنا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: the Israeli president says the regime is, quote, in the depths of a real crisis, warning of a civil war in Israel. Moscow blames increased intelligence gathering by the U.S. for the drone crash over the Black Sea, saying it will react proportionately to any future provocations. And a new poll shows the recent collapse of a number of major American banks has caused concerns among U.S. taxpayers. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital town. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Israeli president has expressed great concern about the future of the regime, saying Israel is, quote, in the depths of a real crisis. Isaac Herzog made the remarks as the occupying regime is facing a major political crisis over controversial judicial reforms pushed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Herzog also warned of a civil war in Israel, claiming that it was his red line and that he won't let it happen. He also unveiled a plan proposing alternative changes to the judiciary to replace Netanyahu's unpopular plan. However, the Israeli cabinet secretary confirmed the extremist coalition has turned down the president's proposal. The drive by Netanyahu's far-right cabinet to go ahead with the reforms has evoked regular weekly protests in Israel, attended by hundreds of thousands of protesters. If the initial proposal is passed, it will mean greater cabinet sway over selecting judges and limiting the power of the Supreme Court to strike down legislations. Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and Al-Quds took to the streets in support of the Palestinian prisoners in their struggle against the Israeli repressive measures. Dola Alassi reports from Gaza.
Every Tuesday, Palestinians in Gaza hold a rally supporting the prisoners. Palestinians in the Palestinian territories and different places across the Gaza Strip took to the street at the same time in what is called marches of anger. Protesters condemned the Israeli crackdown against the prisoners and expressed support for the detainees' civil disobedience actions. Palestinian prisoners in the Israeli jails have pressed ahead for the 30th consecutive day with their civil disobedience actions, protesting the regime's repressive measures initiated by the far-right minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir. With the approaching of the fasting month of Ramadan, the prisoners' disobedience actions are expected to intensify and even culminate to an open-ended hunger strike.
Palestinian prisoners' actions include refusing to step out of a break time, wearing a mandatory brown jail uniform, undergoing the so-called daily security checkups, and chanting the word freedom from more than 4,000 prisoners at a time. The Israeli occupation fears an escalation in Ramadan, like what happened when the Palestinian resistance responded in the 2021 Al-Quds Sword operation against the Israeli violations.
The National and Islamic Forces expressed their concerns over the international silence against the Israeli human rights violations and urged the international community to immediately take action.
Today, we call on the international community to fulfill their duties and obligations and save the Palestinian prisoners. We also call on the United Nations to dismiss Israeli envoys Gilad Ardan and Danny Danon.
People of all walks of life expressed their commitment to the prisoners' case and condemned the Israeli repressive campaign against them. Anti-occupation slogans and pro-prisoners banners were raised during the protests. The National and Islamic Committee denounced the Israeli crackdown and said that these measures will never go unpunished by the Palestinian resistance.
These rallies across the Gaza Strip and the occupied Palestinian territories are a message to the Israeli occupation that violating the prisoners' rights is a red line for the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people. We will never allow the Israeli occupation to breach the prisoners' case anymore.
As the fasting month of Ramadan approaches, the Israeli regime intensifies its violations against the Palestinian prisoners. In time with other parts of the Palestinian territories, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip confirm their absolute support and readiness to defend the Palestinian prisoners. Alal Asib, Gaza.
Well, the UN Special Envoy for Yemen says a recent Iran-Saudi Arabia deal on the resumption of diplomatic ties can prepare the ground for peace in war-torn Yemen.
Intense diplomatic efforts are ongoing at different levels to bring the conflict in Yemen to an end. We are currently witnessing renewed regional diplomatic momentum, as well as a step change in the scope and depth of the discussions. Allow me to also take this opportunity to welcome the recent agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to resume diplomatic ties, which was facilitated by the People's Republic of China. This dialogue and good neighborly relations are important for the region and for Yemen.
Grunberg was referring to the China-brokered rapprochement between Tehran and Riyadh. He also told the Security Council that Yemen's warring parties need to seize the opportunity to take decisive steps toward peace. Yemen and Saudi Arabia are currently in negotiations aimed at extending a UN-backed truce that expired in October last year. Riyadh, along with some regional allies, and backed by the U.S., launched a war on Yemen back in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Years of aerial strikes and shelling, as well as blockade by the Saudi-led coalition, have devastated the impoverished Arab country and left tens of thousands of civilians dead in Yemen. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited Moscow. The visit comes as Syria is reeling from a devastating earthquake that killed tens of thousands of people in the Arab country and the neighboring Turkey. Marina Kortunova reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin held talks with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the Kremlin. The head of states of the two countries are in constant contact as relations between Moscow and Damascus are developing in various areas.
Thanks to our joint efforts and the decisive contribution of the Russian armed forces, significant results have been achieved in Syria in the fight against international terrorism. This makes it possible to stabilize the socio-economic and domestic political situation. Unfortunately, the Syrian people faced another very serious problem, a catastrophe, an earthquake. This, of course, exacerbates the situation. As real friends, we are trying to support you. As you know, our units under the Ministry of Emergency Situations also worked here, and representatives of the armed forces stationed in Syria are also contributing to the fight against the consequences of the earthquake.
Meanwhile, Assad expressed support for Russia's special operation in Ukraine and thanked Moscow for its help following the earthquake.
This is my first visit since the beginning of this special operation in Ukraine, and I would like to repeat we fully support your fight against neo-Nazis and old Nazis. I'm talking about the old Nazis because the West has always received them on the ground and now continues to help them. We support this special operation not because our countries are friends. Our position proceeds from the fact that the world really needs a stabilization now, otherwise it will come to collapse.
This visit has several important components. Syria survived a devastating earthquake with many victims. Syria needs economic help and assistance. Syria has problems with energy prices, which have risen. As an important ally of Russia, it will receive this assistance. The second component is no less important. A meeting of representatives of Iran, Turkey, and Russia at the level of deputy ministers of foreign affairs is to be held in Moscow, where a potential unfreezing of relations between Damascus and Ankara will be discussed. The very fact of such negotiations in Moscow already speaks of a positive trend.
The situation in Syria and bilateral military cooperation were discussed by the defense ministers of the two countries. Sergei Shoigu, in a conversation with his counterpart Ali Mahmoud Abbas, expressed condolences to the Syrian people in connection with the February earthquake and stressed the importance of close contacts, which are aimed at maintaining stability in the Arab country in the field of defense and the fight against terrorism.
The visit by the Syrian president is indicative of strengthening ties between the two countries. The Syrian-Turkish dossier is another important outcome of this visit. The near future will show whether this will lead to the restoration of ties between Syria and Turkey. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Moscow has blamed increased intelligence gathering against Russia as the main cause of a recent U.S. drone crash over the Black Sea. Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu made the remarks in a phone call with the Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Shoigu said drone flights near the Crimea Peninsula are provocative and could lead to escalation of the situation in the Black Sea zone. The Russian official also warned that his country will react proportionately to any future provocation. Since the incident happened, the U.S. has been accusing Russian fighter jets of downing its surveillance drone over the Black Sea. Russia rejects the accusation, saying the drone crashed due to sharp maneuvering. Austin retorted to Shoigu's remarks by saying that U.S. aircraft will fly wherever international law allows, warning Russia to operate with caution. Canada says it will send more artillery ammunition and air defense missiles to Ukraine as part of Ottawa's latest military assistance to Kiev. According to Canadian Defense Ministry, the new military aid package includes thousands of rounds of artillery ammunition and a dozen missiles. Ottawa will also provide Kiev with training ammunition for Leopard 1 battle tanks donated by Denmark. The government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has offered over $730 million U.S. dollars in military aid to Ukraine since the war started with Russia last year. The U.S. and its Western allies have already pumped billions of dollars worth of arms and military equipment into Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly criticized Western countries' military assistance for Kiev, saying it only serves to prolong the war. Asian stocks have plunged as the liquidity crisis of Switzerland-based global investment and financial firm invokes fears among investors and creditors. Japan's benchmark Nikkei dropped 1.3%, while Asia-Pacific shares outside Japan fell nearly 1%. Sentiment was fragile and a nervous air hung over markets after Credit Suisse's stock plunged as much as 30% overnight, causing the Swiss franc to suffer its biggest drop in 7 years. Credit Suisse has, however, announced that it would borrow over $50 billion from the Swiss central bank to reinforce itself. The move follows a decision by the firm's main stakeholders not to inject money to the group. Global stock markets are in turmoil since last week following the collapse of U.S.-based Silicon Valley Bank. And the recent collapse of a number of American banks has caused major concerns among U.S. taxpayers. Now a new poll shows nearly 85% of Americans believe taxpayers should not have to pay a price for problems caused by irresponsible bank management. The two-day survey showed 77% of Americans believe shareholders and executives who profited from a bank in the days before it failed should have to return those funds to depositors. The survey came days after the Silicon Valley Bank collapsed on Friday, causing stock markets around the world to swoon. 2 days later, New York's Signature Bank also closed. On Wednesday, U.S. stocks fell sharply as turbulence at Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse revived fears of a new banking crisis. No disruptions across Britain as hundreds of thousands of public sector workers walk off the job. Teachers, civil servants, junior doctors, and others have taken to the streets over their continued calls for better pay. London saw a mass demonstration that coincided with the government's new budget announcement. Saeed Pudaza has more on that.
Out of classrooms and hospitals and onto the streets, tens of thousands of the nearly half a million striking public sector workers yet again calling for better pay and conditions. The biggest number striking over 2 days this week, teachers, 300,000 of them.
Schools are in crisis because of a lack of funding. There is not enough money going into the schools. It's not just about the pay for the teachers and for the support staff. It's about the basics in the schools.
This is the second time this year teachers walk off the job.
As part of the long-running wave of industrial action that has swept the United Kingdom in the past few months, today it's kicked up a notch in a momentous day of walkouts to coincide with the announcement of the budget by the country's finance minister in Parliament just down the street from here.
Among other things, Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt promised $115 billion in cost-of-living support for families. Ahead of the walkout, the teaching unions were asked by the government to call off their strike in return for formal talks. The unions said that was a precondition they wouldn't accept.
There's already enough barriers to us taking strike action. It's really hard to actually get a mandate to take strike action. We will talk if a decent offer is put on the table.
A decent offer is yet to be made, and in the battle of hearts and minds, striking workers are still winning, with health workers and teachers enjoying the most support. Primary school teacher Chris says the government has some political choices to make.
Teachers don't want to strike. I want to be in school. I want to be with my class today. So I certainly hope there won't be strikes, but there may be more strikes if the two sides can't make an agreement.
Cost-of-living protests and walkouts in the UK have been going on for months now, with strike fatigue nowhere in sight. Saeed Pudaza, London.
Professor of Economics Rodney Shakespeare has told us about the reason behind the industrial actions that are crippling the UK economy even further.
Whilst that extraordinary demonstration was taking place, something even more extraordinary, indeed mind-boggling, was taking place in the House of Commons. The actual reality of inflation is round about 15, 17, 18 for most people. But if they have mortgages, the effective inflation for them is at least 20%. Point number one is the government is saying, oh, well, it's 10%. And then came the mind-boggling bit. They're then saying, oh, yes, and by the end of the year, in some magic way, it will have gone down to 3%. So you see, the government is lying about inflation. They're putting a preposterous supposed figure for inflation at the end of the year. The strikes are there now, and there's going to be an even worse strikes because the government is going to endeavour to settle for figures on private sector pay, sorry, public sector pay. One other point. There is no mention of one of the biggest causes of the inflation, which is the movement of the NATO military alliance to the east. That and the killing of tens of thousands of Russian Ukrainians. No mention at all. The situation is weird. It's building to a huge conflict. And the strikers, the government is going to try to face down the strikers, but I don't think it will win.
Millions of French protesters have taken to the streets in the capital, Paris, urging lawmakers not to back President Emmanuel Macron's pension reforms bill.
Work is not made to enslave people. Work is also a means of emancipation. So people are taking to the streets. They are right. In any case, in France, we are vaccinated against any form of authoritarianism. There is no need to be afraid at that level, even though it's unfortunate that it's happening in such a confrontational way.
Riot police maintained a heavy presence throughout the protest, moving to control unruly protesters. Since the introduction of the unpopular bill several months ago, France has been mired in protests and strikes. Industrial actions have caused disruptions to the country's transport and energy sectors. Protesters demand the government scrap the bill that proposes a rise in the retirement age from 62 to 64. President Macron, however, has been pressing ahead with his plan, arguing that the change is necessary due to the country's deficits forecast. The Senate has already approved the first reading of the bill. There will be a parliamentary vote on the legislation on Thursday. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor, give prophets on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Human rights group Al-Mizan has found that the Zionist regime's drones or unmanned aerial vehicles have killed at least 2,146 Palestinians and damaged 3,332 homes from 2000 to 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, Atollah al-Attar, 35, gets anxious in the evenings. He lives on his family's farm in the town of Beit Lahia, in northern Gaza Strip, close to the boundary with the occupied Palestinian territories. Evenings are when the Zionist regime's drones most often fly overhead. On this particular January afternoon, he softly explained why he has an acute fear of drones. He said, "The incident is very painful. In May 2019, he was working as a security guard at a wedding venue in Beit Lahia. He was taking a break with a friend, Khalid Abu Ghaligh, 24, when they saw and heard the Zionist regime drones flying overhead, which was not unusual. Al-Attar thought the drones were just surveilling the area, but then the men felt the explosion. Al-Attar said, the explosion made a huge sound, and the shrapnel from the missile flew at us. Shrapnel hit Al-Attar in the eye and the legs. The pain was excruciating, but he mostly recalls his friends' cries for help. One moment, Al-Attar remembers, Abu Alir was eating a meal and drinking coffee in nearby shipping container. The next, debris and shrapnel had hit Abu Ghaligh in the head. And by the time an ambulance arrived, he was unconscious. It was while Al-Attar was receiving treatment for his wounds at the hospital that he learned of Abu Ghaligh's death. A subsequent Human Rights Watch report stated that the Zionist regime drone had bombed a metal shipping container outside a businessman's villa and found that none of the individuals killed or injured by the Zionist strike had any ties to armed Palestinian groups. Doctors amputated Al-Attar's foot, and he now walks with crutches. He has four children, but he is currently unable to work, neither as a security guard nor on his family's farm, harvesting strawberries and grain. He said, Israeli regime drones are not only for reconnaissance and killing, they also sabotage water farms by spraying pesticides. I have seen this before, and the drones give me constant anxiety. They killed my friend, and they almost killed me. The Zionist regime began using drones in the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians in 2004, according to Al-Mizan, and nearly a decade later, they have grown to be the most lethal weapons, particularly in assassinations and attacks on crowds. Drones have much longer flying times, states Human Rights Watch, and some are able to operate continuously for more than 24 hours. Military researcher Yusuf al-Sharghawi, a retired Palestinian Authority major general, said that the Zionist regime's most used drones in Gaza
are the quadcopter and the Hermes 450, the latter of which conducts nighttime surveillance with its infrared sensors and can carry missiles. He said, drones take videos, track and assassinate. They also direct bomber aircrafts. Israel is looking to develop these drones to have the most powerful drones in the West Asia region. But in Gaza, they are the most lethal weapons and violate international humanitarian law. Palestinian factions have downed drones in Gaza most recently on January 27th, and with Hamas saying that important sensitive information was obtained. The Israeli regime's war on Gaza during the summer of 2014 brutally demonstrated the destructive reach of drones. While Defense for Children International Palestine found evidence suggesting that Israeli regime forces directly targeted children that summer, with drones killing at least 164 children, other attacks carried out by the Zionist regime throughout Gaza targeted many more civilians. Anwar al-Zanin, 43, an employee of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, had reported that an Israeli regime strike had damaged a water line near his home in northern Gaza Strip town of Beit Hanun, and the municipality sent workers to repair it. Sofyan Abu Harbid, 49, and Majdi Shabat, 50, were repairing the water line when an Israeli regime drone dropped yet another missile nearby. All three men were injured by the strike and taken to the hospital. Abu Harbid's leg was fractured, and Shabbat sustained injuries to his back, arms, and hands. Azanin was more seriously wounded and died later. Now, Abu Harbid refuses to work while Israeli regime drones are in the sky, as the attack produced a lasting psychological trauma. "The event is still terrifying me," he said, adding, "At first, the presence of drones just meant it was monitoring our movements, but now the army intends to hurt and kill us from all directions, sea, land, and air. The Israeli army can kill us without justification." Hala Abu Hajar, 38, lives in the village of Johr, east of Gaza City. She is a widow and the mother of four children. Drones are active in the area, she explains. Like Al-Attar, who was injured by the drone strike in Beit Lahia, Abu Hajar also notes that the drones come out most often in the evenings. They are so high-pitched and loud and deafening vibration that it feels like they are another occupant in her home. During the 2014 war, she was walking with her children when she saw an Israeli regime drone drop missiles on a car and a motorcycle. She's now more afraid of drones than warplanes, she said. "Sometimes when my children are playing near the house and they hear the sound of drones, they run back into the house. They are afraid the drones are going to bomb them." She believes their fear is justified, and she's also afraid. "Evenings at home should be peaceful," she said, "but the drones make this impossible." There is barely a moment when she's not thinking of the drones and what they are capable of. The attacks feel unpredictable, even though their buzzing sound is unmistakable. She said, "Whenever I hear the drones, I feel danger nearby. Tension, headaches, anxiety, and sometimes I can't sleep." According to Mehr News Agency, the Zionist regime withdrew its troops from Gaza in 2005. 2 years later, though, the regime imposed a crippling blockade on the Palestinian territory after the Islamic resistance movement Hamas rose to power there. Ever since, the regime of Tel Aviv has waged three wholesale wars on the territory. Observers say the combination of the siege and military assaults is meant to render what is already the world's largest open-air prison even more uninhabitable. Over the past months, the fabricated regime of Israel has also ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities throughout the occupied territories. As a result of these attacks, dozens of Palestinians have lost their lives and many others have been arrested. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the West Bank and East Al-Quds last year. In January 2023 alone, well over 30 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed. The United Nations marked 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank in 16 years.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Return of Nazi. Part 2.
Each European citizen has a bank account number which can be used in any European country to access banks for transactions because of a common banking system across the EU, and the euro, which is a single currency, has made it easier for citizens to shop. And also, the Schengen political concept allows European citizens to freely travel and specifically work in all European countries. This has caused European countries to have a shared market and also a shared labor market. When the breakneck speed of the industrial and economic growth of the US and USSR was turning the world into ashes, at a time of the crazed speed of Japan's economic growth, Europe had to establish itself as an economic superpower. The euro was a dream the Europeans had to achieve. The euro, which is the common currency of the countries of the European Union, is the blood in the veins of the economies of the bloc, and Frankfurt is its economic beating heart. More than a third of Frankfurt's population is made up of migrants today.
And
this is how Europe's uniform and cohesive economy survived and made growth on the shoulders of its industrial giants. So much so that today the products of well-known big companies have engraved Europe in the collective memory of everyone around the world. To all of us, Europe is defined by its economy.
Which, with Britain leaving the Union, this leaves two major countries, one economic power and one strategic nuclear power, Germany and France, basically determining most of the policies of the Union and using the Union for their interests. The French interest being a player on the world scale, the German interest being to export as many BMWs to as many countries that you can imagine.
The economy was the most important reason for the formation of the bloc, but it was not the only one. If the madness of the likes of Hitler and Mussolini was supposed to be stopped from casting dark shadows over Europe again, if Europe was able to survive the shattering rivalry between the East and West, if Europe was supposed to be able to battle upcoming military and economic powers in the years to come, it had to unite. Frankfurt, which is home to the European Central Bank, is considered Europe's and Germany's economic hub. It is also where the world's, the European Union's, and Germany's largest industries are usually based or hold their exhibitions.
Different immigration histories and different reasons for being pro-immigration or against immigration. The as far as Germany is concerned, we have Germany is the economic power center of the European Union, which means that the demand for labor is still very high, which also means that Germany needs immigration, because otherwise it can't grow economically. Now, it's always difficult to sell to a public that you need, let's say, 1 million immigrants a year. People do not necessarily like the idea. So then it's useful, it's helpful if you can import refugees, which have a sort of humanitarian reason to be here.
Member countries relinquished an important part of their power and national sovereignty to a huge international union, and in exchange got many things. They became part of a huge and powerful political institution. The political and economic support of the bloc could protect them against numerous crises.
Myself, as a European citizen, maybe, I don't know how these decisions have been taken, so people feel also that power has been moved away from the national countries to a European level, and this feeling of dissatisfaction also adds to the frustration that again leads to a protest vote.
Faced with the problems of today, which are immigration, refugees, terrorism, and there is a threat.
What will the fate of the European Union be? Where will extremist right movements lead it to?
For a hierarchical structure between countries. You speak of an empire if there is a system of countries with a center and a periphery. Countries that are nominally sovereign but de facto have to follow the lead of a central power. Like, for example, in the West for a long time, the American Empire. Or in the East, in fact, the Russian or Soviet Empire.
But a large portion of the issues of Europe's extremist right is related to the fear of migrants. Migrants who usually come toward Europe from the north of Africa or the Middle East. A united Europe is now a huge and powerful empire again, an effective institution. This is the realization of the same sweet old dream. This time, all roads lead to Brussels. At times, the city of Brussels is considered the symbol of the European Union, especially when it comes to extremist right parties.
When they want to showcase the interference of the EU in their country, they point to Brussels as the enemy. For example, they say we will stand up to Brussels. The reason is that Brussels is the symbol of the European Union, the headquarters of the European Parliament, and is the city in which most of the European Union's institutions are located. Wherever you see the flag of Belgium and Brussels, you see the flag of the European Union next to it. But this promised land could not remain divine forever. The man-made heaven of the Europeans had many attractions, especially for people who lived in other countries, in deprived lands, in war-stricken countries, regions grappling with droughts, places that looked nothing like Europe. If mankind had been able to create an ideal model for transnational governance after years, why shouldn't it be the right of all people to live under these circumstances? Sixty, 70 years ago, where people are sitting now and taking in the sights of Paris, German Nazi soldiers who had occupied the city were sitting. But as you can see, it very soon changed, and now tourists who are here from across Europe are here because of the European Union and its open border policy. There are also many migrants who come here and put on shows and play music. Maybe these are the causes of the French to ask themselves, why among all the people who are in the city of Paris, many are black, many are wearing hijabs, and many are foreigners? This might make him feel danger because they might not consider these people tourists and think that they are people who are living among the French and are changing France's culture. The process of migrants arriving in Europe sped up, and this itself changed the image of the continent. Europe was not white anymore. The change in the social fabric was inevitable, but it created many crises. This was the most important one, the re-emergence of a nightmare. Almost a year before the chaos surrounding Brexit, two terrorists attacked the office of Charlie Hebdo magazine, a tragedy in response to other bitter events, the harassing of Muslims, the burning of the Quran and others, tragedy alongside other bigger tragedies. A tragedy surrounding the re-emergence of nightmares, the rise of extremist right, or in other words, Europe's fundamentalists. Two main views existed in Europe's foreign policy. One was the Atlantic-leaning view, a view toward the American continent and especially the U.S. The British mostly had this view. The other one was a pan-European view, which said that the Europeans are in actuality of one nationality and race and have to have relations with one another. Our outlook should be focused on Europe. This is the viewpoint which caused the creation of the European Union. And the Atlantic-leaning view caused the exit of Britain from the Union, which is known as Brexit.
Now, if you look at the European Union, these parties are a threat. But for the moment, actually, the Brexit and the election of the Trump have consolidated the feeling that the European Union is essential. If you look at the public opinion, they are not anti-Europe. Actually, in France, the proportion of people who say we need to be united has been going up.
European countries needed a mechanism to guarantee permanent peace, a mechanism that had to simultaneously contain the infiltration of Russian communism and American imperialism, a mechanism to keep the European dream alive, and the bloc was Europe's response to this need to keep these streets happy and safe.
And I think that for doing this, we need to restart from the very, very basic level of our all-day life, our all-day relationships, and then to rebuild a different way to do in politics, to take in the public decisions. But before, we have really to reconstruct this sense of a relationship.
The general problem of empires is that the periphery needs to be supported by the center. For example, the periphery has to make sure that the center has to make sure that the governments, the semi-autonomous governments
of peripheral states collaborate with the center. For that, you have to give them something. Now, for a while, the center of the empire can extract enough resources from the periphery to pay for its costs and even leave some profit. Over time, this becomes more and more difficult. And the larger an empire becomes, the more difficult it becomes. And the question that I'm raising is, for how long will Germany, and it's basically Germany, it's not France, be able to pay for the cohesion of this thing called European Union?
But now, everything is on the edge. Huge economic challenges every once in a while strike one of the member states and affect the economies of the rest of the countries. The unstoppable number of refugees creates a devastating economic and social issue every day. And the right has found an opportunity to emerge again. They believe Europe does not need to remain as one to be European. In a world in which its most powerful politician's trump card is pulling out the US from different international treaties, Europe's right parties are critical of the European Union more than anything else. Instead of sacrificing their short-term and nationality for a common, collective, huge dream. On the one hand, there was a long line of countries which wanted to join the European Union, and on the other, different countries were trying to be inspired by this unique structure and pass similar international treaties. The Arab League, the African League, and many other international organizations and treaties tried to structure themselves in a way to reach the blissful European model. A few years ago, when the European Union was at the peak of its power, Eastern European countries requested that they join the bloc. One of the most important conditions for this to happen is the economic situation in those countries. The Central Bank of Europe studies countries based on the stability of prices, exchange rate stability, GDP, and a number of other important economic indicators, and then allows these countries to become a part of the bloc. Most Eastern European countries became part of the EU, and this in turn later caused the confrontation with Russia, which exists until today. Even a country like Turkey, which has a huge part of it located in Asia, requested to become a member state, and the process took years. The Europeans had different issues with Turkey, from economic topics to human rights issues and others, and in the end, Turkey's accession to the bloc did not happen. But maybe one of the reasons was that Turkey is a Muslim-majority country, and it's neither Christian nor Western. The year 1988, and this important speech by Margaret Thatcher in Bruges, only 13 years after the days that the Iron Lady was taking part in protests in support of a referendum, today what happened to Thatcher is repeating for many other politicians. Many of them, under the shadows of the rise in the extremist right, have come to the conclusion that the bloc is not the best way to achieve the aspirations of their people. They think that a bloc, which was once created to help countries make progress and guarantee security for each other, has now turned into a heavy burden and is decreasing the speed of growth and change. But this is the statue of Joan of Arc, the symbol of France, the leader of the French against the British in the Hundred Years' War, someone who is later captured by them and burned at the stake. But years later, deemed innocent by the church and beatified. Today, Joan of Arc is the symbol of France's nationalism. This is where France's National Party gathers, and the leader of the party, Ms. Marine Le Pen, holds her gatherings and makes her speeches. Extremist parties are now slowly coming to power everywhere in Europe, with young leaders, extreme nationalist slogans, and an insatiable appetite in strengthening national sovereignty. The slogans they chant are at times like the fascist ones vocalized during the first half of the 20th century. The growing interest of the people in these parties can be the beginning of a huge crisis for the EU. Politicians who don't like the European Union have now made it to European parliaments. But today, the policies of European governments and their fragile coalitions, which have been struck because of the emergence of the extreme right, are like these locks that those in love attach to these bridges as a memorabilia. These policies are locked, and for the time being, there are no solutions for them. Maybe after Britain, it might be the turn of other countries, for example, France.
A country like France has, Britain has, but Britain and France in the same European Union didn't work because they both have nuclear arms. They both sit on the United Nations Security Council as permanent members. And since they have different interests, different regions in the world, it was always hard for them to agree to the European Union to develop a common policy. But now with Germany and France, it could be that the Germans will be willing to underwrite sort of some of the traditional French foreign policy concerns. One doesn't.
All these events have one important reason. Today, the challenges and crises European countries are dealing with differ from what they faced in the past. Europe has been completely rebuilt and is back at the peak of development. The Security Council and NATO have for years maintained peace in Europe. The USSR has collapsed and a force from the East does not threaten Europe anymore. But the U.S., with the strange policies of its most unbalanced president in its history, and China, with its most devastating trade deals, have targeted Europe's not-so-resilient economy. Today, new dangers threaten Europe, and the bloc cannot do much in any of these instances. The same flames which are buried under the ashes of all this concrete and metal, economic crises, refugees, social gaps, anti-immigration sentiments, and extremism. Now the bloc is so overwhelmed by its internal problems that it does not even have the influence and credibility of the past. They cannot even stay fully committed to the implementation of a simple international treaty.
Great Britain have destroyed Europe and got out of it. So very, very clever decision, because they have fleet from the ship coming down. So I think that that was the reason of decline.
This is my assessment during my trips. The exit of Britain from the EU, the possible exit of some other important countries in the future, weaker European countries joining the bloc, new challenges which the bloc faces, and the people's leaning toward nationalist movements which oppose the EU, all have come together to create a not-so-bright future for this important international institute.
That is Brexit, and the other is affirmation of independence by Hungary, by Poland, and somehow by Greece. So Eastern Europe is in revolt against European.
The weakening of the strength of the European Union as one of the present era's big powerhouses makes its rivals happy. That's why Trump welcomes Brexit. Or, for example, it's for the same reason that Aaron Banks, one of the most ardent supporters of Brexit, has extensive trade relations with Russia. Competition with 28 small countries is easier than coming face-to-face with a big bloc. And it doesn't seem that China is too upset about the weakening of a troubled Europe either.
The Germans think that they are not Germans, they are Europeans. So everything that's good for Germany is by definition good for Europe. They don't see, they don't think they are Germanizing Europe. What they think is they are Europeanizing Europe, because they turn it into into a copy of Germany. The Americans were like that. Americans believed that everybody should be like Americans, and that was not Americanizing them, but it was humanizing the world. Yeah? And the Russians, basically, when they still had an empire, functioned in the same way, or the French. Yeah? So I think it's part of an imperial outlook that you think that it's good for other people to be like we are. Yeah. And it's natural for other people. You don't have to do much. You only have to give them a chance to wake up, and then they will immediately see, let's become Germans.
At least at the level of European politicians, the worries are not that deep. it doesn't seem that collapse, or at least the familiar way it happened in the East, is being expected for the European Union. It doesn't seem that we are witnessing the breakup of the bloc the way it happened to the League of Nations. Will the European Union remain intact? Will France remain in the EU?
They're not large enough to pose a serious threat to European Union and to European integration. And certainly if the European Union is going to collapse, which I don't think is going to happen, it will be more due to internal struggles between different interests of different countries than of the role of the radical right.
So I think that the European Union as it stands today will not collapse, but it might transform, which we can see already with Brexit and phenomena related to that. But I do not think that a Europe that is made out of independent national states.
Nearly 70 years after the Paris meeting, the Europeans only have two options. They either have to make the structure of the bloc compatible with today's world, or go back to the pre-war era, the era of dispersion, a Europe which is prone to the rise of the likes of Hitler, Franco, and Salazar, something that is not too far-fetched with the re-emergence of the extremist right.
The European Union is a unique political structure, and in order to understand it, you have to understand the individual member countries and their very complex relations with each other and with the center, and the power relations between the two most powerful states, France, Germany, who have a very complicated relationship between them. And then they also have interests with respect to the periphery, which sometimes overlap and sometimes they don't. So the complexity of this system is enormous. And that will continue. So in order to understand it, you have to really take a very hard and good look.